It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy Iannocco, Renee Ritchie, Alex Lindsay, they're all here. We'll talk about why Apple pulled back Beta 7 of iOS 12, the rumors about the next iPhone. Will there be a MacBook this fall or new AirPods? There's some evidence there might be. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 623, recorded Tuesday, August 14th, 2018. Bill Tong on my to-do list. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Molecule. Molecule is the world's first molecular air purifier that reduces symptoms for allergy and asthma sufferers. For $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com. And enter the promo code MACBREAK. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple and smart. That place is ZipRecruiter, where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/MACBREAK. And by Quip, the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Visit GetQuip.com/TWIT to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we get together with some of the best minds of the Macintosh world. Well, really, it's the same three guys. But they are some of the best minds in the Macintosh world to talk about Apple. Mr. Renee Ritchie from iMore.com, host of Vector. We are currently flying over, it looks like, JFK in your on your big screen TV. It's great to see you, Renee.
Ah, Leo, man, it's great to see you too, Thank you for having me on the show again.
He's teaching us the ways of South African meat consumption.
It's the very best meat in the world.
I have ordered a lot.
All the biltong. Good going, Leo.
I have just ordered a lot because of you. And it turns out, weirdly, we started talking about it, and Alex Lindsay whips it out and chews on it from pixelcore.com. Alex, how did you happen to have some biltong just to hand?
Well, I have done a lot of work in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, and I just got hooked on it. I mean, it's and so I constantly am trying to find it in the U.S. There's a couple places that I've ordered it, and this is, and so I just ordered some new biltong that turned out to be the best I've had in the U.S.
Where was that from?
And that was from Bull and Cleaver.
Oh, all so, right. So I'm just ordering some from them as well. I just want to make sure that they were the best.
No, that was it. And so I just, it literally had shown up this morning. And so when we started talking about it, I was like, well, how opportunistic is that?
I only have one thing to say, Bull and Cleaver. How much biltong do you want to sell? Also with us, another foodie, Mr. Andy Iannocco, Iannocco.com. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. I feel like just to offset all the meat talk, I should as my pick of the week, just pick soy curls. This wonderful vegetarian meat substitute that's shelf stable, very filling, easy to cook, easy to enjoy, a treat for both young and old.
You notice I'm not running. Soy curls. Running.
See, if I were first on deck, I would have said nothing but good things about Bill. Again, I'm looking forward to trying biltong. I've got biltong on my to-do list, but again, perhaps there are some of our listeners that are already starting to like feel something rise in their throats. I don't know, all this talk about meat, and I just want to make sure they know that they are represented, they are loved.
Do you want to explain this image?
Ooh, yes, that is Leah Thompson of Space Camp and Back to the Future fame. I did an onstage Q&A with her at Boston Comic Con / Fan Expo last weekend. And she was absolutely delightful and charming and wonderful. And I'm glad that I dressed up in my respectable geek costume. Because it was hard to equal or even approach the amount of class that she presented on that stage. It was a really cool weekend. I had media passes, and I intended to just imagine that it's Friday and I'm doing a podcast, and I'm thinking, it's Friday, it'd be nice to pick up my passes on Friday. Maybe I'll just take the camera, and I don't know if I'll come on Sunday, but I'll try to come in on Saturday. And and then I get a phone call from a friend said, yeah, we had a guy was going to do like 8 different Q&A panels, like had an accident and couldn't come. Could you like be here at 4 o'clock and start interviewing people? And so I went from there to like maybe desperately trying to make a train in 30 minutes, and then talking to Leon from I can't remember his name, but he was in a Dog Day Afternoon. He played Leon. He also played the Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride. This weekend they had like almost the entire cast of The Princess Bride, almost the entire
did
cast
you interview Wallace Shawn? Because if you did, I'm yes. gonna die.
Oh my God!
You can keep Leia Thompson, as adorable as she is. I want to interview Wallace Shawn.
Oh my God! It was
inconceivable.
Like,
it's inconceivable.
I hope someone got a picture of it, because that's going like up on my wall. Even just talking to him backstage was amazing. Talking to him on stage was amazing. Talking to him backstage afterward was amazing. He is just so obviously there's going to be lots of questions from the audience about The Princess Bride and even the Pixar stuff. So I just said, I asked him backstage, is it okay if like when we're just talking together before the Q&A, we talk about Vanya on 42nd Street? and it was like, he was like,
My Dinner with Andre, which is another, that's a movie all about talking with Wallace Shawn.
There was, again, just like seven. I could have gone to 7 different topics like that before we even got into like into Pixar movies.
Does Wally, though, there must be a little bittersweet irony in the fact that he is there because of his role in Princess Bride more than anything else? Or does he say, no, I'll take it?
I didn't ask him about that. I don't think anybody specifically asked about that sort of thing. Obviously, he wouldn't be at a cast reunion at a FanCon if he weren't okay with it. Someone asked him a question about like certain roles that he had taken, and he gave the funniest response that amounted to, sometimes when you're a character actor, you take jobs because they offer you money to do it, and money is useful for many different things.
That's true.
But he said this in like the period of like 5 minutes, in perfect timing, and whereas everybody was like, oh, that's the answer. As it went on, it got funnier and funnier and funnier, even though it was just, oh, like I said, I'm hoping against hope that he will be in Boston again sometime, and I'm hoping against hope that whoever it is that arranges such things lets me talk to him again, because, like I said, that was the one I was totally nerding out about. That was the one where I only had less than 24 hours to prepare, but I must have spent the night before. I was up super late, like watching all my favorite Wallace Shawn movies, stuff that I hadn't seen before. Just so that I would, my one thought I was holding in my mind was, I don't care if the audience hates me. I don't care if I never get asked by this organization to do Q&As again. I just want Wallace Shawn to think I'm cool.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I would have reacted.
Absolutely.
By the way, it's not My Dinner with Andre the Giant. That's a different movie.
No.
Although one I would also go to see. I think it was you who recommended this book on Audible, As You Wish.
Yeah.
Which Mr. Shawn's in along with a number of other people.
I'm sorry, Chris Sarandon. I'm sorry. I just remember his name. Chris Sarandon, who played Prince Humperdinck. Who's my first interview.
Yeah.
Humperdinck.
Anyway, this is a great book if you love The Princess Bride. It's the memoir by Cary Elwes, who was the pirate. Well, he was
Dread
a bunch
pirate
of
Roberts.
Things.
Dread Pirate
he was,
Roberts.
He was that, but he was, but sort of. Well, it's a long story.
He's Wesley.
He was Wesley.
Wesley.
Yeah. And Wesley writes his memoir, and it is a really great story to read.
Yeah.
So it was you who recommended it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite Audible books of this year that I listened to this year. Well, we should probably talk. I don't want to, but we should probably talk about Apple. No, I do. There's a lot to say. Should we start with Business Insider's? I said Business Insider. It is Business Insider, but they're just calling it thisisinsider.com. Kiff Leswin.
The Insider Empire.
The Insider Empire. How an invite-only meeting at Apple's luxury loft in New York set the stage for one of the biggest subscription businesses in the world. In this title, luxury loft in New York was the thing that caught my eye. I didn't know Apple had one. Is that where you have been, Renee?
Yeah, that's where also like when you see some of the YouTube hands-on, the early YouTube hands-on go off, that's where that is all shot. It,
Is that where Tim Cook lives when he's in New York, or is it just a...
No, and I've never seen any evidence of Super Bowl parties, frankly.
Too bad.
I've looked for it.
Man, that'd
but
be awesome.
No, but it's just a space that they can... I think it started off with HomeKit, where they wanted to be able to put stuff in permanently so that they could demo it. And then they're getting to do more elaborate demos, like with things like iMac Pro and MacBook Pro. They want a room that's dedicated to VR, and one that's dedicated to music editing, and one that's dedicated to photography, so they can sort of demo the thing in all these different professional applications. And having to strike that and reset that every time gets tedious. So I think they've just settled on this pace of constant demos, and it made sense for them to set it up there.
Les Wing writes about this event that happened in April 2017 in the trendy Tribeca neighborhood, Apple's luxury loft. A group of over 30 mostly independent software developers. The developers at Apple's loft soon realized the hardware giant needed something from them, he writes. Apple was a few months into a major shift in the App Store's core business model, and it needed buy-in from developers. This is a, and you may have, we all may have noticed this as more and more apps became free with in-app purchase or subscription, and fewer apps just 99 cents. Apple apparently was concerned that of the downward pricing pressure on iPhone apps, which is absolutely the case. You know, people choke now when they see a $10 app or a $20 app. We used to pay $150 for applications, right?
And if you remember, Steve Jobs famously announced iAd as a way to help developers make money off free.
And that didn't work out so good.
No.
So Apple reportedly called this subscriptions 2.0. The idea was, now there's, on the one hand, if you're really cynical, you could say, well, Apple is just looking for a way to make more money. But, of course, they were also looking for a way for developers to make sustainable businesses.
And they make
less
money off subscriptions. I believe in the second year they drop down to 15%.
Well, that's one of the things Apple did, which is we want you to consider making your app subscription. And, you know, yes, we'll take 30% as we do of the purchase price in the first year. But after the first year, if somebody stays a subscriber, we'll only take 15%. So that's the carrot. I think I was waiting when I read this. I think I read it this morning. I was waiting for kind of a earthquake of outrage from users. Is this a good thing for users? I mean, it's clearly a good thing for developers and Apple. Is this a good thing for users?
I did a show a while ago where I had a 1Password, which went to subscription long ago, Drafts, which was just moving to subscription, and a pCalc, which had no intention of moving to subscriptions. And it really did vary on a case-by-case basis. And it's the crux seemed to be if you were incurring costs for maintaining users, and you know, on an ongoing basis, like you're providing server levels services, and you were doing a lot of things to support the app, it made sense for both of you to be on the subscription model, because that way you didn't have to time, like, artificially create this big 2.0 release, and these are the features you'll get just to drum up support. You could release features as soon as they were ready. And if you were really just making an app and releasing it, then subscriptions made no sense, because it just seemed like an onerous burden on both you and the customer.
So I think the customers, I talked about this on iOS today. I think that the problem is when people are used to purchasing apps outright, they think of it like a toaster. Well, I bought it.
It has the same problem as every other app model, in that once upon a time, we only bought a handful of apps. We bought Photoshop, maybe Office, a couple things, and they were hundreds of dollars. They came in boxes, and you would time, maybe you'd only buy one a year and alternate the years that you upgraded, and it was a big deal. But then we came to the age of popular apps, and suddenly everyone wanted to download 10 games because they were bored on the weekend, and that doesn't sustain $10, you know, much less $30 pricing. So the app prices all plummeted. And now even I think subscriptions are just a temporary measure too, because very soon subscription fatigue hits and you're like, I really can't afford 4 subscriptions. I want 4 apps, but I can't pay $10 or whatever, $10 a year for 50 different apps. And it's, I don't think it's a stopgap. It's not going to solve the
Alex, yeah. You've developed apps. You sell apps. What do you think?
Yeah, what I worry about with any kind of business model that is a pay once is that it's hard to, as a developer, to keep doing it. So if there's an app that I really want, to be honest with you, I kind of want to have a small subscription, or I want to know that they're going to be making money. It's why I'm not that excited about free apps. You know, I don't want to depend on free apps. I mean, I'm, you know, either they're selling some kind of advertising or there's something else going on. or I'm afraid they're not going to be around, you know. And so the I think that we do have to think about the sustainability of the of what's going on. And if we're willing to, as users, buy those, I think that that's, you know, that's the way we go. I definitely subscribe to some pieces. And what I find with a lot of the apps that I've subscribed to is that they are doing updates regularly. And what you're doing is as you have that, that creates a much more stable business flow, business model for the developers, which allows them to, you know, invest. When you know that you have a certain amount of money coming in over time, you now can invest in resources. You can invest in, you know, hiring more people. You can do all of the things that you need to do to create a more stable business plan. And so, you know, that when you have that situation where you get a surge, you know, then it's hard to figure out what you're going to do after that, you know, and I think that it's good for the ecosystem. So I think that indirectly it's good for the user. I do think that, that Renee is correct that you could end up with, you know, I know that I now look at subscription models, and if I see a subscription, I kind of go, well, do I really need that? You know, like, you know, it's definitely a, I think through that process. Now, if the subscription is low enough and the payoff's high enough, then I'm fine with it. But it's, I do think that it's important for us to figure out how those developers are going to make a real business out of it, you know, as opposed to, and I don't think it's for everything. I think that the other thing is that I don't think that a flashlight model or a little, you know, like a little app that does something cute. If I've developed that, I definitely would not be thinking about subscription. I'd be like, it's $4. But once you start getting into, I mean, some of these apps that people have released are very, very complex. And, you know, it any other time they would have cost $40, you know, on a Mac. And so the fact that they're only, you know, a small subscription, I think makes up for that to some degree.
Yeah, but there's another side to it. I just I do think that whenever I see a really well-made piece of software and the maker is charging a fair price for it, like not the price that people want to pay, but a fair price for it, that does make me happy because I think that the more money that they're getting from that app, the more likely it is they're going to be able to continue to support that app years and years in the future. And so the result is more cool apps, more awesome apps in the App Store. There are a lot of backsides for the users, though. One of them is I really think that auto renewal should not be possible. I think that every time you're about to be charged for another year's worth of access to a certain app, or when a 30-day trial expires and you're about to be charged, that doesn't happen automatically. You will get a blip coming up saying that, oh, by the way, your subscription has lapsed. Push this button to buy another year's worth of this thing, because I can't tell you the amount of money that I've wasted because there's like a photo app or something that I tried that it was kind of okay, but after like 3 or 4 days my attention was grabbed by a much, much better app, but then I forgot all about it, and now here it is, I'm being charged another $7 for it, and I have to remember to keep looking at that page to look at my active subscriptions. It's also a pain in the butt when you have an app like 1Password, where I want them to keep making money. This is one of the most important apps that's in the stable for both Mac and iOS, but when it comes time where I'm really in the middle of a workflow and I need to sign up for a new account for some new server that I've put in, and it tells me, oh, by the way, you can't create new stuff because your subscription has lapsed. Go over here and buy another year's subscription. And it's like, but now I've got the $40. It's not that. It's that now I have to stop everything. And either stop everything and be distracted for a few minutes to go and enable the ability to get this password recorded in 1Password, or as is more likely, I will simply either just, okay, I'll get that, I'll do that later, and either, I don't know which one is worth, write down the password in a much less secure place, or B, forget to write it down at all. And that's just a big pain in the butt. So it's not neutral to users. I think that there's some work to be done to make it better. But again, anything that helps developers be able to charge a rational amount of money for all the work that they're doing, I'm completely in support of that.
I think this became – my thinking changed on this some years ago. Remember Delicious? I use Delicious all the time for bookmarks. It was free. It was a great bookmarking site, and eventually got sold to Yahoo and just kind of disappeared.
Yep.
And a guy, but I was completely reliant on it. A guy named Maciej Czyglowski noted this. By the way, he's a great thinker. We got to get him on Triangulation at some point, Karsten, because he's a local guy. Created this thing. This was a Delicious equivalent. We even used the Delicious API called Pinboard. But he said, but it's not going to be free because I would have no incentive to keep it up to date. I would know if I'd have to run the servers. You got to pay for it. At the time, he was paying it, the longer you waited, the more it cost, which was actually quite clever.
I love that.
At the time, it was a one-time only thing. Now it's $11 a year, worth every penny. And that's when my thinking changed, because I was so reliant on Delicious. And by giving it away, they basically undermined themselves and they stopped developing it. But Maciej, by saying, well, but look, this is going to be a steady income, I'm going to keep it going. And he has, and we completely rely on it for my workflow for all of our shows, including this show.
You remember, Bill, there was that excellent blog post from Will Shipley, it must have been like 5 years ago, called Farmers versus Miners.
Right.
Where he said, like, there are some developers who want to build something great, and some developers want to strip out every cent they can and sell to a VC or an internet company.
And unfortunately, there's such a lot of money to be made right now being a miner that a lot of people are doing that. But I would rather work with farmers. And so I don't. Now, this has come up in an interesting way. So I think a lot of the problem that people have comes from the fact that it's hard to change business models. So once we start giving away Twit, it would be really, and I'll never do this, but it'd be almost impossible to say, now you got to pay. Because people just say, but no, it was free. Why am I paying now? So you can't change in the middle of the stream. You have to decide at the beginning and go with it. But I feel like the analogy I use on iOS today is when you buy a toaster, that's it. That's the thing. It's not going to get any better. If it breaks, if it's under warranty, they'll fix it. But otherwise, after a year, you're going to pay to fix it.
Toaster as a service.
A toaster is not a service. It's a toaster. And so people understand that. And it's $35 and that's that. But software is not like a toaster. A lot of software, like Pinboard, has a server that has to be run. That's a constant cost. And you also want your software to be updated, whether it's new features or maybe even more importantly, security fixes, bug fixes. You want the attention of the developer. That costs him money. That's not, you know, nobody can work for free. Here's where it's come up lately that I think is really controversial. Plume, which makes a router. Now, until recently, routers were toasters. You'd buy a $40 Linksys, you'd use it till it broke, and then you'd get a new one 10 years later. But more recently, I think we understand routers are not toasters, that they need to be constantly updated, at least for security, if not for features. And in particular, mesh routers, which are, and Plume is a really good example, they are always, they say, monitoring usage on your network and update constantly to change QoS to shape your bandwidth so that everybody gets a fair amount and everything works. And now they've said, and this was very controversial, because remember, you were just paying for it like a toaster. No, you're going to have to pay us $100 a year or whatever it is for a subscription. And the thing that was really controversial, and if you buy a Plume and you don't pay the subscription, it will stop working.
Yeah,
that was very controversial. Now, Eero, one of our sponsors, does the same thing, but it's not black or white. The Eero will continue to work, but I gladly pay $99 a year for Eero Plus, which has a lot of additional features, including constant updates. And more, I'm thinking a router is not a toaster. It needs to be regularly updated. And I think, frankly, people need to start thinking of a router as a subscription, as a service. People don't want to do that because for years it was a toaster.
No, I agree completely, because not only it's not only from a security point of view, which should be pretty obvious that these things need to be checked and they need to be updated for security patches, but also just the simple way that your needs and your use of a network keep changing. And every time you drop a new box on this network, you would like to have some help in trying to make sure that your port forwarding are set up. You've got your firewall is still intact, even though you've installed the ability to connect to certain local files remotely. And the ability, if it's just pay us $30 a year just to keep the lights on, that's no good. But if you develop this as a we will essentially have this device phone home, so to speak. And tell us its current operational state, like the status of its firmware, the status of its security, and we will make changes or ask you to approve changes if necessary. That's the sort of thing that people would much rather have taken off their hands. So it depends on how you present it. If you present a value to a consumer, people will pay. Simply hijack their something that's working and say, unless you pay up, it will not be working again. That doesn't work except for certain parts of Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, the mob controlled areas of the city.
But there is so much pushback against Plume. People are furious.
Oh, and right, so, well, or at least so. That wasn't the deal I signed up for.
Well, yeah. Oh, but as an, by the you way, know, I have Plume, and that. as a I'm grandfathered in for free. So it is the deal you sign up for if you buy a new Plume. Right. So if you had a Plume before, as I did, they said, no problem. You don't have to ever pay the subscription. You have a lifetime subscription. One of the deals Plume offers is $200 for a lifetime subscription. So I guess for people who want to think of it as a one-time purchase, you could do that. It's just much more expensive.
Just like you said, it wasn't the expectation. They created expectational debt because you buy it, you expect it to just work. And when it doesn't do that, something right. doesn't match.
Right.
I try to think of it as an investment. Like Andy's point earlier, when I buy an app, I want that app to be around a year from now, 5 years from now, because I get used to using it. I develop habits and workflows that depend on it. And me just giving them $2 and expecting it to work for 10 years is really poor investment strategy. So I've said, hey, Craig Hockenberry, can I stuff dollars in your pockets when you're at WWDC? Please take more money.
Yeah,
please.
No kidding. Yeah.
But we just need sensible ways and scalable ways to do that. And I think we're still in a lot of like Amazon famously tried a an all you could download subscription service. There's one for the Mac as well. And Netflix has done that with other forms of content, and Texture did that with newspapers. And it's not hard to believe that one day apps will be in the same or similar business model, where there's one subscription and you pay that every year and you download all the apps you want to use and everyone gets reimbursed the way that Spotify works. It's just we're still so much in flux.
Well, and I think that I do think that, to get back to something Andy was talking about, just forgetting. I mean, I think that there was one point where I looked and realized I was paying like $150 a month in subscriptions. I think that made me more sensitive to it. Because same thing. I'm experimenting. I go, I'll just try this for a month, and then I just forget about it. It's definitely worth it. I think one of my complaints is that it is hidden. You know, so it's not something that you can just go look at my subscriptions. I mean, you can, but it's not like a easy thing to do. So you have to, go into the app store, the iTunes and app store, and your preferences, and then you have to click on your Apple ID, and then you'll see subscriptions.
Although
it's kind of hide it down there.
Yeah, but it's of all of the ways to do this, at least it's all in one spot.
And no, that's good.
I can go there and it tells you very clearly what you subscribe to, what's going to expire, what you'll renew, and you could. And I go there regularly, and everybody should, because you'll be surprised all the stupid things you've subscribed.
I wonder if that's not a concession, because like it's hard to see a company like Netflix or HBO allowing Apple to do subscriptions for them if it wasn't auto renew, because that's what they have on their side already. So it'd be a huge step back.
HBO is a perfect example, because HBO, I literally don't have an HBO account, and then unless I forget, but I won't have it except for Game of Thrones. And so Game of Thrones comes on, and I turn it on. And then I let it run, and then Game of Thrones ends, and I turn off, because it's the only thing I care about on HBO anymore. And
well, that's their fault. They need to make it. They need to make something on that keeps you subscribed. Yeah. That's actually their up.
It's the five Game of Thrones spinoffs, Leo, that we'll be getting in a couple of years.
Yeah, it's on them. But it is. But Andy, you gave an example which kind of is counter to that point that subscriptions should not automatically renew. 1Password. There are things where you would want it to automatically renew, so it doesn't bug you. So it just keeps going. As long as you want 1Password or Netflix, it should just auto-renew. I would hate to have to renew Netflix every month or year. Yeah.
So long as maybe the best way to do it is, what I don't like is that by default, it will simply auto-renew. What if the first time it has renew, it asks, and there's a checkbox saying automatically renew, never ask me this again. That would be a fine compromise.
There's a compromise, yeah. A lot of subscriptions now are yearly. $99 a year seems to be kind of a standard. Everybody seems to be doing that. I think I understand when people don't want a lot of subscriptions, but I think you got to think about, you do want services. You want a router to be updating.
You want people to have a reason to keep on.
Yeah, but and
when it's 12 things though, it's hard. And when it's 20, and when everything is a
subscription, it's not that hard. You just put it on your credit card, and it just happens, right?
But also, but I mean, paying for it all.
I would like to minimize the amount of nickel and diming that I'm feeling. I'm going through every time where I love this transaction where I will give you $163. You will give me a Wi-Fi router that will work great. And I don't like the idea of I will give you $163 and you will give me a router that will work for a time until I start paying you $6 a month to keep it running.
Right.
And it's, it also it is also particularly in the point of view of software, you developers can really be shooting themselves in the foot, because from your point of view, $5 a month is just not a whole lot of money. But just like Renee is saying, like it's $5 here, then $6 there, another $3 there. And before you know it, by the time like you you really audit all of your subscriptions and auto pays, you've got like $130 worth of apps that you thought that you kind of liked. But that's like every single month you have you're paying for a new $90 a year or whatever.
That's why you should check. But I also don't think you should be freeloading. And I understand people don't have unlimited funds. Some people can't afford it. But that is not that doesn't because you can't afford it doesn't mean you're not getting value for money. It doesn't mean you can go buy a Bentley for $100 because afford a Bentley.
It means the subscription has to give value. That's the bottom. Like you can't just add a subscription model something just to add a subscription.
No, absolutely. Megan was talking about a QR code reader that her son inadvertently downloaded for his iPhone that was $50 a year.
Yeah,
there's no reason.
There's some really bad subscription scams on the App Store.
Yeah, so there are scams, but obviously the amount that you charge should match the amount it's going to cost you to give these services. I mean, it should be a fair thing, but
yes, fair and equitable.
Absolutely. But as long as it's fair and equitable, I think it's unfair and inequitable for a customer to say, "Well, look, but I just can't afford all this stuff." Well, then you don't get it. You don't get to use it. If you can't afford it, you don't get it.
If you don't want the auto renew as well, is one of the things that I've started to do because I was after I realized I was paying so much, I will subscribe and then I put a little reminder. I put a little reminder to unsubscribe tomorrow. And so I literally unsubscribe because you still get it, and, you know, for the period. If you subscribe for a month or a year, you'll get it for that year or you'll get it for that month. And so I just, you know, things I'm not sure about, I've learned that I have to do it while it's still fresh or I'll just completely forget. And so I just literally the next day, I just unsubscribe. And I'm like, well, if I miss it, then I will resubscribe. You know, but it's, you know, I just kind of set an expiration date on that process. And I do think I'm a little leery of the ones that I really don't like are big numbers that are a yearly subscription. Those really bug me because I feel like, you know, if you want a subscription, it's fine. And I like the idea that you're going to pay a fair value for an app over a year if it works. You know, so let's say that app might be worth $30 or $40 and I'm going to now pay little bits all the way up. If I decide halfway through that it wasn't worth it, then I turn it off and they don't make as much money. And that keeps them, keeps our app developers honest as well of, you know, constantly updating it and making sure that it's a great app. But it allows me to decide, you know, what, you know, I think that having it grow so that if it worked for a year, I paid a price of an app, you know, more than a price of a coffee, you know, which is what it is now. You know, like when I think about apps, I go, oh, can I sell it for $4? And if I can't think about how to develop it, which I think of a lot of ones like that, and I'm like, I can't develop it and sell it for $4. so then I move on.
Well, that's another argument, right? If you want developers to make great apps,
and I think
there's plenty of people who are making that equation. Doesn't make sense for me to make this because I won't get paid appropriately.
And one thing I'll say is that one of the reasons that the iPad doesn't get updated as often is because all the apps pretty much run on it pretty well. And one of the reasons that's the case is because people can't sell, you know, very many $60 apps on the iPad where they could put the kind of R&D that's required to take full advantage of the hardware. So you end up with, you know, a lot of apps that kind of run on lowest common denominator. And I think that, you know, if people were making more money on those, they would push the hardware a lot harder and it'd be more fun. And so finding ways to, you know, make sure that I think that Apple more than anything else is just trying to find ways to make that ecosystem healthy.
There was a great article by Ben Thompson a couple of years ago about bundling, where, you know, he says everybody hates bundling until you're no longer bundled, and then you see what the individual price for everything is, and it starts to add up. And I think that's in this case too. Like we talked about it previously, you get Spotify, you get Apple Music, and you get pretty much all the music. You're not paying for Atlantis Records separately, and Interscope Records separately, and Celine Dion separately, and Beyonce separately. But that's what's happening right now in the TV market, where every network and every company is spinning up its own streaming service and asking $10, you know, a shot here for CW, for DC and Marvel.
There's already noises being made about unbundling in music as well.
Absolutely.
And the problem with that is only a Beyoncé or a Celine Dion can do it. And that if you're an up-and-coming young artist, that is a pretty tough proposition. Oh, you got to buy our app and subscribe if you want to listen to our music.
I mean, and it goes back and forth. So people want the unbundling because they think they'll make more money, but then they realize that people very quickly develop subscription fatigue or payment fatigue or micropayment fatigue, and then they start to bundle again. Yeah. And that's why I think inevitably we'll get bundles by content type where you'll subscribe to your news, you'll subscribe to your movies, you'll subscribe to your music, you'll subscribe to your apps, and it'll be much fewer much less cognitive load.
Interesting.
And I think we're reaching I think we're reaching a saturation to a point where I think that the market has gotten pretty crowded. And I think that the problem really is going for people, newcomers coming into this, is going to be that a lot of us have reached equilibrium. Like, we have the content that we need. You know, for my household, my wife likes watching So You Think You Can Dance. And so we have Hulu because it at least means she can download it without ads. I want to be able to watch the Steelers, so we have YouTube TV, and I also have the NFL subscribed in India, so that way I don't get any blocking. And then I have HBO when Game of Thrones is there, and then I have Netflix. You know, and it's like it's kind of like, okay, I can't even handle that kind of content. Like, that's all the content that I have time for, and more. And you know, when I saw Disney, Disney's going to put a bunch of stuff out, and I'm like, fat chance. I'm not even getting a rise out of that. And when people talk about new subscription services, I'm like, I've got my YouTube TV, I've got for live, I've got all my little slots filled now. And I think that I don't think I'm the only one.
Yeah. What a developer.
That's the big thing.
Go ahead, Andy.
I was just saying that's the big risk. You think that, hey, you know, I'm selling out concerts. I've got this huge like street team. All my fans love me. They're more than willing to spend $6 to $10 a month to have exclusive access to my albums and stuff. And then that's when you find out that they love you, but they love being able to simply click a button on Apple Music and get the album. They don't love you enough to find an extra $8 a month for you, or to automatically remember to renew you when they switch credit cards or whatever. It's a tough world out there.
What do Renee, what do developers think about the bundles, like the Humble Bundle and stuff like that? Is that good for them?
There was a lot of outrage at first when they first started happening, because they believed that there was already so much pressure to devalue apps that it was just contributing to it. It was one more thing in literally training your customers to wait for your app to go on sale or to be bundled or something like that. But I think we saw a lot of those kind of protests early on. I think over time, those have sort of lessened. And I don't know if that's just because it's learned helplessness and they're all in the fetal position going, you know, we'll try it out. We'll try anything at this point. Or if it's just they figured out that there are ways and there are times when it makes sense. But I think there is, you know, it is a big concern. Apps went from being incredibly scarce to being an overabundance. And that is totally destructive for a marketplace. It's like wooden toys to Hasbro manufactured plastic toys. It goes, you know, from artisanal, from craft to mass production. And no industry survives that without massive disruption. And we're seeing that in apps for the last few years.
Let's take a break. When we come back, this is a little bit scary. Macs can be remotely hacked when connecting to Wi-Fi for the first time. Lily Hay Newman, writing for Wired, will tell you what you should do about that.
Just love Black Hat Abstract Day. When that comes out, everyone just reads all the abstracts. Publish, publish, publish.
There are a ton of things coming out of Black Hat and DEF CON. DEF CON was this weekend. And we'll have
Why
a
does
few
Black Hat have to be so close to voting primary days?
No. Like, oh. Could you do it a little earlier just so we could prepare? Yeah. You saw the voting machine, hall of voting machines that were all hacked.
By 11-year-olds.
But one was a website, Secretary of State's website, but an 11-year-old. Rachel Toback showed how easy it was to get root access on a voting machine that is currently in use in 18 states. You go into the voting booth, 2 minutes later, you have root access to the voting machine. You could change counts. You could do anything you want.
And if you live in Georgia, maybe you want to go back to like some of a Lord of the Flies sort of way of figuring out who leads, because that's probably going to cause less disruption than whatever's happening to your electronic voting.
There was the one district in Georgia that had something like 200 registered voters but got 800 votes. Yeah.
And they're saying we're fine. Everything's fine.
It's close.
So long as the party that decides these rules decides that they're being hacked in our favor, it's fine.
That's really what it is, isn't it? As long as it's okay, as long as it's good for us, I don't care.
who's going to, I ask you, who's going to pay for this? Well, Congress did approve $365 million worth of grants that you haven't asked for. Yeah, but in principle.
In Mud Creek, Habersham County's Mud Creek precinct in Georgia, 276 registered voters cast 670 ballots, 243% turnout. But you know what? We've been trying to get voter turnout for a while, so I'm happy. I'm happy about that.
And they're making up for the folks that aren't coming, you know.
That's right.
You know, they say vote early, vote often.
Yeah.
You know, maybe what you said before about that pricing model where the sooner you buy this app, the lower the prices. Maybe we make a new rule that says the earlier on voting day you vote, the more votes will be counted as your vote.
Yeah,
so
if you vote at
7 a.m., you get 10 votes. If you vote like a half hour before, that's when you get your one vote.
I like that. Our show today brought to you by our fresh air in the studio. It smells good, doesn't it? Even though there's smoke from in the air from fires, from the whole state of California burning down, apparently. There's VOCs. There's all sorts of stuff. We've got a molecule air purifier, and we love it. So Molecule reinvented their air purifier. You're probably familiar with these. See that HEPA filter on the video there? That was invented in World War II for 50 years of antiquated technology. It was just basically a filter. Molecule does a lot more. It does have a filter, but it also has the PICO air purifier, photoelectrochemical oxidation. It captures and eliminates particles that get right through a HEPA filter, particles 1,000 times smaller than those a HEPA filter can catch, including allergens, mold, bacteria, viruses, airborne chemicals, the volatile organic compounds coming off paint. It can capture them. It is an amazing thing, and I know it is because we moved into the country about 4 years ago, and Lisa, ever since, has woken up with sinus headaches from her allergies. Till we got the molecule. We got the molecule about a year ago. She's so happy. She wakes up without a headache every morning, except, and this is how I know it's working, when we move. If we take a, you know, we go on vacation or we take a night somewhere else, she gets the headache again. It's amazing. It really works. Molecule. It makes it easier to cope with asthma, allergies, and just dirty air. And if you work in an office where they can't open the windows, like here in our studio, this is a must. This is a must. The technology was funded by the EPA, extensively tested by real people like me, verified by third parties in university labs like the University of South Florida's Center for Biological Defense and the University of Minnesota's Particle Calibration Laboratory. It's kind of the Apple of purifiers, too. See that aluminum? It's beautiful. It's aluminum shell. It will pair with your Wi-Fi and automatically order new filters when needed, which is really nice. You can connect Molecule to your Wi-Fi network, control it remotely from your smartphone. I use the Molecule app on my iPhone, but you don't need to. So if you're one of those people who doesn't want that, no problem. You can obviously completely control it from the buttons on the top. We liked it so much, we got one for Michael, our son, and then we got one in the studio. And we're already talking about getting some more. It covers a lot of territory, too. You can have 600 square feet, and it'll cover it all. And we actually leave. I like sleeping with the windows open in my room. So it's doing a lot of work, but it keeps it clean. I love it. $75 off your first order. I'm glad to say they're back in stock. Molecule.com. Best new product of the year, according to the Edison Awards. Time's Best Invention, one of their 25 Best Inventions of 2017. Popular Science, 10 Greatest Home Innovations of the Year, an air purifier that actually works. Find out more on the website, Molecule, molecule.com. And if you want $75 off your first order, use the offer code MacBreak. MacBreak. Really can't say enough good things about the Molecule. Molecule, Molecule.com. Offer code MacBreak. All right. Hacking a brand new Mac remotely right out of the box, Lily Hay Newman. This is, it's another one of those black hat demos. It uses Apple's
abstract.
is Apple's device enrollment program and its mobile device management platform. This is so that employees can walk through the customized IT setup of a Mac without having to get IT involved. However, according to Jesse Endall, chief security officer of Fleetsmith, which is a Mac management firm, and Mac Belanger, a staff engineer at Dropbox, we found a bug that allows us to compromise the device and install malicious software before the user is even logged in for the very first time. By the time they're logging in, by the time they see the desktop, the computer's already compromised. Good news, there was a fix in 10.13.6 High Sierra last month. But there are still plenty of devices with older versions of the operating system that will be arriving. And, you know, I presume if you wipe your drive and start over, you're also vulnerable. It's part of the setup. The way it works, it checks in with the Apple servers to say, I'm a MacBook with this serial number. Do I belong to someone? What should I do? And if the serial number is enrolled in that Dapper MDM, then a predetermined setup sequence happens, which I guess could include malicious software. You'd have to do a man in the middle. It doesn't sound that easy. They can only demonstrate a version of it at Black Hat because Endall works at Fleetsmith, which does this kind of thing, so they can set up the server. I think this isn't something to worry about too much, and Apple has fixed it.
I bet you the one time when you really want to listen to someone who says that they found a bug is, hey, it's like 3 months before Black Hat. It'd be really great if you fixed this before Black Hat.
Well, the good news is obviously they did notify Apple, and that's why it was fixed before Black Hat. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's another there's another one. This is from DEF CON, I think, which follows right after Black Hat. This is Patrick Wardle. We know Patrick well, right? Former NSA staffer, Mac hacker. This is using the mouse key. This is one hard for Apple to fix because it uses mouse keys, which is mouse clicks, which is synthetic clicks. It's part of the accessibility features, right?
Yeah.
And so he's using Apple script and mouse clicks So Apple had patched the initial mouse key hack, but then he was testing it some more, and by accident, he pasted in, instead of a down and up command, you know, mouse down, mouse up command, he pasted in two mouse downs, and it turned out the system misinterpreted the second down as an up and completed the click, and so the fix bypassed it. He says, it's this ridiculous bypass I found by incorrectly pasting code. I tripped over it because I wanted to run out and surf, and I was being lazy. So Apple has not yet responded to Wire's request for comment on Wardle's findings. He admits he didn't actually tell Apple the details of his research ahead of his talk. But he says after he alerted the company, Apple shouldn't have left sloppy, exploitable bugs in the same fix. Well... sometimes people have to go out and surf.
Yeah. Well, also, like, they rush to get the fix out, and then you have to test so many different things, and people are human and make mistakes.
I think that's why I think shame on Patrick for not telling them ahead of time. But
there was also this wonderful thing, and I love the people at Project Zero. I think they provide a phenomenal service to the internet. But there was Project Zero was saying Apple should give us a bug bounty because we find this stuff because we're hired by Google to find it. Which was hard to process as well.
Yeah.
Or give it to charities. They didn't want it for themselves. They wanted it for charity. But my understanding is that Project Zero was offered an opportunity to participate, and they said, no, we're Project Zero. So awkward to do it later.
Okay, rumor time. Rumor time. I think we're about a month away, roughly, from an Apple event. Yep. Loop Insight. Is Marcus working for Loop now? The Loop now? I don't know. Marcus Brownlee, the 2019 iPhone 10 models. They're talking about his video. I get it.
Yeah, we talked about that. Yeah, you know, the usual sources sent out all the.
Oh, this is that? Never mind.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Forget about it.
The rumor from today was from a bunch of analysts who said that the iPhone will have 512 gigabytes of storage. It'll be compatible with iPad, with Apple Pencil, and the LCD version will be $699.
$699 is a good price. The small LCD version.
It's the exact same price as the iPhone 8 is right now, which makes exactly all the sense in the world.
Oh, okay. The Pencil's new. We didn't know that, but that would be nice. 512 gigs of storage, maybe because the Samsung Galaxy Note 9 came out with at $1,250 bucks, a 512 gigs device.
What usually happens is that over time, because NAND flash is like a very volatile commodity, and sometimes it's really scarce and expensive, right, and sometimes it's not. And sometimes they start making newer versions that are actually cheaper to buy than the smaller, older versions. And because I think Apple still gets a lot of it from Samsung anyway, they would probably have made these decisions at similar times months and months ago.
Right.
Yeah. Also, it's such a lot of people are not going to be interested in the cheapest one of whatever it is. So if you give them an opportunity to give them more money,
yes,
whether there's a whole lot of advantage to the new feature, the added features or not, that's always a good thing. I will say myself that if I will always do myself, and I will always advocate, however much, if you were budgeting $800 for whatever the next phone was, anticipating a price increase, and you're, oh my God, it's only, they actually dropped the price, it's only $650. I'm still going to spend that $800, and I'm going to buy as much storage as I possibly can. If it's a trick, it works for me.
They do make a half terabyte iPad Pro. Yeah. We don't know how well that sells. It's a little different with an iPad, I guess.
Well, it's a lot different because this is something that even Apple is promoting as why you don't even need it. It is so suitable as a computer that we're not even going to call it a computer because it's better than a computer.
Got it.
It's a more interesting question when you talk about things like the new Samsung Galaxy Note, where it's like, wow, here is a device with looking at all the stuff that my 2-year-old MacBook has and noticing that this phone kind of smokes it in almost every category. And you can still plug it directly into HDMI and get a desktop interface for all this sort of stuff. I'm not tempted because I personally just don't like Samsung as a primary device. And not when Google has their own Pixel phones out there. I think there's a lot of added value to the Pixel brand.
The Note 9 starts at 1,000, but for $1,250 bucks, you can get 512 gigs internal storage. In both cases, you have an micro SD card slot, so you could add another 512.
512. Internal storage is actually higher than that, isn't it?
Internal 512. Well, the big one is at 512, 512, so a terabyte total. Right. The little one is 128. 512, which seems enough to me. Actually, it's not technically limited to 512. That's just the biggest micro SD card Samsung currently makes. But the spec would support 2 terabytes, so you could go even bigger if you really wanted to store that much on your phone. I may be crazy, but 64 gigs is enough for a phone.
No, well, not when you consider that now you've got iPhones shooting really wonderful 4K video.
True.
So instead of having to, here's your 8 minutes of film. Now what 12 apps do you want to destroy to get another 30 seconds? It must be cool to have the same attitude towards video that you have towards photos, where I never even bother removing photos from my phone because JPEGs just don't take that much room and there's such an ungodly amount of space. It's almost pointless to even waste the time.
So I bought the iPhone X, I bought the 256 gig model because you got to have more storage. But I have 170 gigs left. So I haven't used a whole lot. Oh, AT&T is calling me. Should I answer? Probably not. I'll just put that away. It's odd, isn't it, that AT&T would call right when I show my phone on the air? I think that's a spoofed number, maybe. Here's another rumor from, I guess, Apple Insider. Nope. This is from the Chinese language site, Chongdiantou. All three 2018 iPhones are going to support wireless charging. That wouldn't be a surprise, right? That means just glass back, right?
Yeah.
Air Power Mat to cost $150 whenever it's available.
Yeah, that's a tough price, I think. That's, you have to, given that.
I don't think it's a tough price. You know why? Because there's all these other choices already. Anybody who really wants a wireless charging, even if it has three, has got one. The only people who are going to buy it are people who are in an Apple store saying, oh, look, the Apple one. And they'll buy it at any price.
It's a convenience thing to be able to take one thing with you that charges all three. So they're
and presumably they're going to have the chargeable AirPods packet when they ship that. So you'd have to buy that too, by the way. $150 for the pad, and if you want to charge your AirPods. Although, here's the good news. And I wonder what this means. You can now get AirPods at Best Buy for $140. They're in plentiful supply, apparently. Does that mean... I'll throw this in for no additional charge. MacBooks. Some MacBooks are now sold out at Best Buy. Does this mean new MacBooks, new AirPods this fall?
It's usually one of the signs, you know, when the angel opened the seventh seal of the Apple event, there was silence in Best Buy.
The i5 with 512 gigs of storage out of stock in rose gold, space gray, and gold. The base rose gold model with 256 gigs. So they're not getting resupplied, I guess. Apple Store still has plenty, I presume. The plentitude of AirPods doesn't necessarily mean there'll be a new AirPod, but the $140 price is low.
And the AirPods themselves aren't probably, you know, may not change. Okay. Walking that back real quick.
He knows nothing. He says nothing. Pay no attention. This is not the vector you're looking for.
I have to say, I do. I have zero. I'm usually interested in new things. The wireless charging, I don't. I don't even like my charging my watch that way because it always pops off.
You have to wireless charge.
I look over.
Watch.
You have to. I know. I just don't like it. Oh. You know, like I know that I have to, and I know that they've saved some space, but I would much rather just plug it in with a lightning. Yeah, I wish there was a little lightning port there that I could use because I would never use the magnetic one again because it's always like it's always somewhere on my desk, and then I look over thinking my watch was charged, and it ends up not being charged. It popped off a little bit, and when I'm traveling, I have a bunch of little lightning cables, and I just plug them all in, and I just don't think it's just not something I'm waiting for.
I'm sorry. It's not Best Buy. It's Costco for $140. And if you don't have a Costco membership, you can get them on Amazon for $144.98.
And admittedly, I wasn't waiting for these either because I was like, oh, I need cables. But now that I've fully gotten used to them, now the cables, you plug your headphones in and you're like, oh my gosh, this is a pain in the neck. This cable is like, this cable that I've had wrapped around me in some way since I was like 14 years old is now this thing that is like, oh my gosh, like this is getting caught on everything. I don't know how I live this way.
If I hadn't lost two pairs of AirPods now, I'd be tempted. But that's, I'm at my limit. So will there be a new MacBook?
I think so.
Apple's going to update everything it can to the Coffee Lake platform. I still am not a fan of the M series chips, although Intel now calls them I series just so that they think we'll be conned into expecting better performance. We're not going to buy it, Intel. We still know they're M class processors. But you'll get whatever the benefits Coffee Lake are in those chips.
And of course, we think that there'll be ninth generation Intel chips in October. So
I went to sleep again and woke up and there was another lake, Cooper Lake. I mean, every time I fall asleep, Leo, there's a new lake.
October 1st, 8-core Cooper Lakes, Cannon Lakes. I don't think Cannon Lake
is ready yet. So usually it's two. It's like Haswell, then Broadwell. And it was supposed to be Sky Lake and then Cannon Lake. But Intel just could not get the process shrink done. So then we got KB Lake and then we got Coffee Lake and Whiskey Lake and Ice Lake and Cooper Lake and blah, da, 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 da. It used to be TikTok, and now it's TikTok, optimize.
The Canon Lakes are the 10 nanometer.
Those are the ones we're aiming.
Nobody could. Yeah. Well, they're no, like nobody at Intel behind. Could figure out how to make. Everybody else is making them, but nobody at Intel could figure it out. Okay, so good. I would love to see a new MacBook. I have to say, I'm so spoiled by my i9 MacBook Pro, and now even Lisa is just by the halo effect. She just sees me tapping away there, and she says,
"It's a new MacBook Air that I think is going to be exciting."
Oh, you think there will be?
I hope it's ready. Yep. It
a Retina
like
MacBook
ready.
Air would be really sweet.
Or it's more like a sub-$1,000 Apple notebook that's actually modern.
How do they position that, though, processor-wise, speed-wise? Is it going to be a slow processor, an i?
No, I mean, right now it's an i-series processor, and it's only slow because it hasn't been updated in years. But I think Apple recognizes that, you know, one, the MacBook without adjective after it, never dropped down in price the way they were hoping it would. It was an incredibly expensive product to make, and it stayed relatively expensive to make. And at the same time, the MacBook Air, which they were hoping to replace, is not you know, they haven't been able to do that.
Right.
And they need something that's under $999. And, you know, as people like Ben Beharin will tell you, Windows is making a lot of money at the sub-$1,000 price point.
Yes.
But that Apple will suck a lot of that oxygen back out of the room if they just update that class of computer, because they're the ones who kickstarted this whole Ultrabook thing. It's their category to own if they want it.
Kickstarted and then ignored. So
yeah.
If you did a MacBook Air, would it still have all those connectors, or would they go to Type-C? They probably just go to Type-C, right?
I'm hoping it'll be a hybrid, because it's really targeted at education, and education is not the fastest adopter.
Right. They're not dongle friendly. And it'll have a Retina display, right?
No, because you'll still need dongles, because you'll need VGA. So, yeah, I mean, it's just the dongles that you get.
There's always a dongle. It's dongles all the way down. Will it have a Retina display? Will it have... So the thing is, how do you differentiate it from the MacBook?
The price. I mean, they do things by price category. And the MacBook was originally intended, if you look at the trajectory, the MacBook Air came out and it was super limited and super expensive. It literally had the Millennium Falcon hatch where you put the ports in. And then the second generation MacBook Air came out and the price dropped a lot, and it kept dropping. And that's the one that spurned the whole Ultrabook revolution. And I think the MacBook, I might be wrong, but I think the MacBook was supposed to do that, be another revolutionary form factor that would get a second edition that would drop the price substantially and replace the MacBook Air the same way the MacBook Air replaced the MacBook. And it did not happen. And so we got a couple years of stasis, and Apple's just decided, fine, we've just got to make a better MacBook Air at this point.
Andy, would you buy a MacBook Air, or would you buy a MacBook?
It really would depend. Let's assume that I'm okay with the keyboard. I think the role of a MacBook Air really has to be the Volks computer. It really has to be the Volks MacBook.
Yeah.
Has to be the one that doesn't say, where you don't have to pace the stage, where your fingers tented and explain why you made certain design decisions. It has to be here. There's a steering wheel here. The radio is there. The shifter is there. It has four tires that we fill with air. Yes, air that you can get at any gas station, any pump. It has seats that are designed to make actual humans sit comfortably. You can't basically say, but the problem with a bucket seat is that what if you're carrying a bowling ball in one hand? That's what I really want the MacBook Air to be. When you go below $1,000, you really don't have the ability to boast about how advanced your display technology is, or just boast about your manufacturing process. As we've been talking about, when you're talking about something that's going to be bought a lot by people in education, you're talking about people who are going to have to interface with stuff that's 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 years old, and you're not going to make people happy by saying, here's all the extra stuff you're going to have to buy. Here's $100 worth of extra crap you're going to have to buy just to plug in the stuff that you normally use. And you really can't get away with that when the shopper for this is probably in a Best Buy and is seeing, here is another notebook with even better specs than this that managed to figure out how to put an actual HDMI connector in there, that managed to put in at least one USB 3.0 actual USB-A type connector in there. It's all this sort of stuff that comes to play. When you're starting to charge $2,000, especially to people who are already not just dyed-in-the-wool Apple users, but they're real believers about it, that's when you can sort of say that, well, the thing is, we thought that you maybe would like to have four absolutely top-of-the-line high-speed USB-C ports. And yes, we know that's an inconvenience to having to use dongles, but realize that if you want now to have three 4K displays, you can have three 4K displays. If you want to have two RAIDs and a GPU, you can have the two RAIDs and a GPU. This is why we didn't chimp out on the USB-Cs. Under $1,000, you have to make a machine that's going to be practical, affordable, and functional. And oftentimes, Apple asks you to be happy with just two of those things.
Yeah, I know. What makes Andy Iannocco happy: opera on Apple Music. Apple Music has launched a new classical music section. This is something that made me really happy. A lot of these streaming services don't really, they act like everybody's really into the modern stuff, and I like classical music. So this is curated by Deutsche Grammophon, and Andy will be happy to know there are a lot of operas on here, including a new visual album, Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, Visual albums are essentially, what is it, music videos? What do you get?
It's weird. They are one of the first ones they put on there is Gounod's Romeo and Juliet. And so you can listen to just the tracks as individual arias, but essentially if you start at the first track, you will be able to watch the entire opera. However, on my phone here, I've not figured out how to turn on subtitles. And subtitles in an Italian or French or German opera, if you're not Italian, French, or German, or an opera student, kind of help you to understand what's going on.
I'll be honest, even in English operas, I can't understand what they're saying. I want the when you go to the opera, they have super titles now. That was a revolution in opera.
If you go to the Met Opera, the seat backs in themselves actually have LCD strips on them. Yep, and you can switch between different languages or turn them off entirely. And they're dimming, they're orange light dim so that you're not distracted by them. They're really wonderful. But I'm really glad to see a streaming music service start to take classical music, realize that there are problems that the regular categories really don't solve.
Yeah.
The number of times where I've just got a classical music album just on my phone, and I have no idea what this track is, because they've decided to they're trying to make it work in a here's the album of the title of the album, here's the album artist, and so every single track is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
They don't have enough lines
from,
that's
the,
why
the abduction from the Seraglio performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra on, and then 18 characters later. And they're also, it's also difficult, like on my Plex server I've had to really create a separate library for opera, because I know it's unfair to all the other people who work on an opera, but I want La Traviata, like my favorite version of La Traviata, I want the author of that to be Anna Netrebko. That's the soprano who sung. I don't remember what orchestra performed it. I don't remember who was Alfredo, who was all the other characters. But again, it's hard to do because the author of this is going to be the orchestra, or the name of the production, or the director of the production. So the idea of having better organization for this is good. Just having a curator who knows that there's more to classical music than Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, and not just Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, but the top five hits of each one of them. And after that, they really don't care. People really can get into the reason why I got into opera to begin with wasn't because there was one copy of La Traviata, one version of La Traviata that was deemed enough. It's that you go into YouTube and you see all these kind of bootleg recordings, and you know that here are eight different sopranos singing the title role, and here are six other tenors who are singing the male lead role, and here are different productions that have.
That's
different
where we got ahead. I agree. Yeah. That would be really nice.
It really is exploration. It really, because opera particularly, it's like hyperlinks where you get in because you might get in because, oh, Romeo and Juliet, I wonder what that opera is like. Right. And then you find that I really liked that soprano, so I wonder what else that soprano has done. And then you find that this one production that you found, wow, that's really cool. What other stuff has the Met Opera done? And so that's how you find yourself getting into this subject, by realizing that there isn't one version of La Traviata. There are 100, and some of them have totally what might be termed wacky attitudes towards what the story is about. So I'm glad to see that being treated as something that really needs to be curated, that really needs active guides.
If I play this to, I wonder if I play this to AirPlay, if it would maybe have super titles or subtitles. I don't know. Maybe where there's more room on the screen. Hey, it's still nice. It's high quality video, and it's a beautiful opera. So. Yeah. I'm glad to see they've added that.
Yeah, and this is another opportunity to plug the Met Opera On Demand app for your iPad and your Apple TV and stuff.
There you
that
get
really
the subtitles.
Is, it's
yeah.
it's yeah. decades worth of Met Opera productions, as recent as a year or two ago, as old as actual video. And these are the ones where let's see three different versions of Lucia de Lammermoor. Let's do one in which Lucia is sort of an innocent victim. Let's do another one in which it's really cool. It is one of those subscription services, though.
That's so. One of the things that's what you want Apple Music to do. And Apple does Apple. I guess that's really unique to opera. I mean, they're not going to do, hey, let's do the other versions of Nicki Minaj's queen, you know, because there aren't other versions. I guess you could with, you could do with a maybe.
It's fascinating. Without getting into too long a tangent, in 30 seconds or less, one of the things I love about all these different versions of the same opera is that they don't change the score, they don't change a single line of dialogue, they don't add anything, but they figure out a way to, what if we simply restage it this way? What if instead of holding a knife, she's holding a gun? And what if the lead decides that she knows full well that she's being tricked, but she feels as though she's been hoodwinked and she doesn't see a happy future for her anyway, so she's just giving up, as opposed to being the helpless dame. It's really cool to watch. That's why it's great when you see all this different variety, and when you have a music service that simply says, okay, we got one copy of the Mozart, we got one copy of the Beethoven, we got one copy of the Bach. That's good. The only classical music people are going to be looking for is what was the soundtrack in that latest wine commercial. There you go. We want to make sure we get the Brindisi from La Traviata, then we're done.
So this is from the 2008 Salzburg Festival. It's Rolando Villazon doing the tenor part of Romeo et Juliette. And that's nice. I didn't even know about these visual albums. Maybe because I'm not a Frank Ocean fan. I don't know, but I'm glad they're doing that. That's great.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break. We shall come back with more. Ralph Nader says Apple should do something. I don't know.
Something, anything.
And also that the Apple car shouldn't be cool or fun.
Should be unsafe at any speed. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter, the best way. Somebody's at my front door. I'm just going to close the iPad. The best way to hire. We found this out the other day. We our accounting manager gave us notice. It's a fairly important role. Without the accounting manager, Andy would not get paid. Renee would not get paid. So we said, we better fill this, because you know what happens, and this happens in any business, especially a small business like ours. If somebody leaves, that means somebody else has to do two jobs. Lisa would have to do all of that work, and she was dreading that. And I said, Lisa, this is at breakfast, let's try ZipRecruiter. Oh, yeah. So she puts the job listing on ZipRecruiter. Now, one thing that we've talked about many times that ZipRecruiter does that's great is it posts your job listing to 100-plus sites and Twitter and Facebook and everywhere, so that the idea being more people will see your job listing, and much more likely you're going to reach that one perfect person. But this is something that we haven't talked a lot about that really is remarkable. ZipRecruiter also uses very sophisticated matching technology. It scans all the resumes it has in the database, I mean, and that's often millions, to find people who have exactly the right experience for the job you just posted, and then invites them to apply. It's almost like an automated headhunter. And then as applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one, spotlights the top candidates, so you don't miss a match. We posted it at breakfast, and I'm still eating, and she's, oh, we just got another. She looked at him, she said, these are good. We got before lunch 5 great applicants. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Before lunch, it made her feel much better. Like, oh, good, we're going to be able to fill this position. We did, I'm very happy to say. Welcome, Cherie. With results like that, it's no wonder ZipRecruiter is the highest rated site, hiring site in America. This really, really works. They are actively helping you find the right person for your job. Try ZipRecruiter free, but you've got to go to ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak, ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. With the free trial, you might get everything you need before lunch. ZipRecruiter.com/MacBreak. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Let's see. What did I tease? Oh, Ralph Nader. He's why is he, stop picking on Apple. He says, earlier, he sent an open letter to Tim Cook saying, and I kind of agree, this has been one of the problems with the new tax bill, is that most of the money's gone to stock buybacks. Apple, number one in that, has spent, I don't know, $100 billion on stock buybacks. No,
than the last one. I think the number is over $200 billion total.
Wow. Which is great for shareholders, but you know, the hope with the tax, The hope with the tax bill was that maybe some of that money would go to hiring and investments and R&D and things like that. But and that's what Nader says. He says you should be using that money to do things like increase your number of employees, shore up the pension fund, R&D, pay the Chinese supply chain a little bit better.
The fundamental problem with all of these is number one, is they're suggested by someone who doesn't actually run a company.
Who doesn't even use an iPhone, as a matter of fact, or a Mac.
He's got a little typewriter. He uses an Underwood typewriter.
Right.
And the issue is that making investments that have – it's like a subscription service. You know, hiring more employees is like a really, really big subscription service that costs, millions forever. Of dollars. And so – And so, a buyback is a one-time thing. It's maintaining. And again, it is about maintaining your stock price. It's about increasing your stock price. It's about keeping your employees. And that is why I think that's the number one reason Apple's doing it is employee retention. I think that is keeping that moving. We should also point out that
everybody on the board and all the Apple executives have significant stock. So they benefit immediately and directly from
the
buyback.
They do, but they've got a lot of money. I mean, they've got more money than they can spend.
Yeah, it's retention of them.
It's retention.
When you look at some of them, they're not the highest compensated people in the Valley by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. And so I think when you're thinking about, 100,000 plus or 200,000 plus employees, I think you're really talking about, those golden handcuffs are much harder to break than people think. And so, if that starts to stall, it becomes an issue. And I wish that they would do other things with the money too. I mean, I think they're doing a lot of good stuff. I'd love to see them do more, more tech outreach, more of those kinds of things that are one time things or one setup or something that we're going to invest, in these directions that, but I do understand the idea of number one, causing a lot of inflation, starting to just pay a whole lot of people more in China. There's a whole equilibrium there that becomes very complicated very quickly. And it's Foxconn doesn't just work for Apple, they're working for everyone. So it's a much more, all of the suggestions that he gave are very complicated, and I'm sure that they seem simple to someone who has never had to actually make payroll.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
Nonetheless, we would like to see all companies show a sincere awareness that the way they treat their workers, particularly their least paid workers, shows a lot about their integrity and their awareness of what their impact on the world is. So I can understand that it's not even the correct solution to say we're going to make sure that all of our workers are the best, most highly paid workers in the entire industry, because, as Alex says, that has a knock-on effect that can produced unanticipated results. But when you hear a company like Amazon just not even show any public interest, any interest whatsoever, that they're willing to talk to anybody about making sure that their warehouses are good places to, are even okay places to work, that's when you start to feel that. That's when you have the ability, the choice between spending, you need to buy a new, you want to buy a new camera, and it's either going to be $1,500 at B&H Photo or $100 less on Amazon. That's when you find yourself, I think I'll go to Adorama. I think I'll go to another store after double checking to see if their employees are being treated better than warehouse workers at Amazon.
A digital birth control app blamed for dozens of pregnancies just got FDA approval. This is, you may be familiar with Natural Cycles. Talk about a subscription. $80 a year. It comes with a thermometer. This is a Swedish product, and if you know anything about the rhythm method of birth control, you know it isn't perfect, but the idea is by measuring a woman's body temperature and her cycles, you can predict low fertility and high fertility times. In Sweden, a hospital reported 37 cases of unwanted pregnancies among women using the app. That's one hospital. But anybody knows this is, and even Natural Cycles says the app's only about 93% effective under typical use.
Yeah.
So it's still, 7 babies out of 100 love sessions.
Well,
that ain't too bad.
You got to say that that's still, I think the pregnancy rate, if you're not using birth control, is something like 42, 43%. And so if there are... if there are people for whatever reason, no need to judge them, don't want to use any form of birth control or contraception.
This is better than nothing.
It's better than nothing, so long as they're not promoting it as a really, really great solution to this problem. Because we've been talking about subscription services. This is an app that can cost you $120,000 a year for 18 years. That's a hell of a subscription for a simple phone app.
I bought two of those subscriptions back in the 90s.
I'm just spitballing here, but why can't they make an Apple Watch app that detects your heartbeat and says, whoa, there, young tiger.
Slow down, whippersnapper.
This is what college costs for a child in the U.S. And you're like, okay, well...
Natural Cycles says 900,000 people use the app. So if you've got a 7% pregnancy rate, well, do the math.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'm sure that they're very clear in the, you know, when you install it. I haven't tried it, but because it's not an issue for me, obviously. But I think that anyway, it's interesting. FDA approval for Natural Cycles. That's a big deal for Natural Cycles.
And to put it into perspective, I think statistically I was just searching while you're doing this, is that, you know, theoretically condoms are 98%. In actuality, they're rated at about 82%.
Right.
So.
Right.
You know. So it's
well,
not,
that's
it's,
what that's what Natural Cycle says. 93% effective as typically used. If users followed directions perfectly, it'd be 99%. So
if they spend if they spend time using the phone app instead of having sex, it's
that's
great.
Good. That's a start.
Maybe that's an opportunity for developers listening. Use the machine learning to monitor what's happening on the Apple Watch to try to detect the changes in pulse rate that happen during foreplay. And once it detects that that sex is probably going to happen in the next 20 to 30 minutes, that's when you start unloading lots of notifications about, oh, text message from this. Oh, this stock is going like this. Oh, did you notice that the Red Sox are now beating the Cardinals by 3 points, and sort of get people distracted from that.
Speaking of in-house productions, Apple is ordering a show about a video game studio from the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia crew. Boy, I'm loving this. This is based on Min-Jin Lee's novel Pachinko, and it'll be a half-hour scripted sitcom.
I think we're mixing.
Oh, that's a different one.
I think this one they're doing one about a game company.
Yeah. Pachinko's different. Okay. So that's another thing that Apple's ordered, a series based on Pachinko, which I didn't read. So Pachinko's not about a video game company? Apparently not.
No, it's based on another book. But the video game company sounds like it will be funny.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you're into video games and you like Silicon Valley, you'll be happy. Yeah.
It'll be written by Rob McElhenney and Charlie Day. McElhenney will take the lead as an employee at a video game studio. Lionsgate and RCG, the pair's production company, will be also co-produced by Ubisoft, a video game company.
How convenient.
How interesting. You know, It's Always Sunny, I don't watch it religiously, but it is great because it's so irreverent and weird. And I think that's a good team to be producing this. And if they can get Danny DeVito in it in any way, form, or fashion, I'll be happy. Apple's going to run out of that $1 billion pretty quick. They might have to put some more money towards.
That is more where that came from.
Yeah. Really? Okay. If I'm Ralph Nader, I'm going to write, "Dear Apple," on my Underwood, "buy more great shows." Ting. Send that off. NVIDIA has revealed a next generation GPU, almost certainly will not be in any Apple products ever.
Yep.
It's the Turing, nicely named, GPU architecture. You can read the article in AnandTech if you want to know the details, but this is something for Alex Lindsay's crowd.
There's been a lot of talk about this at Seagraph. Seagraph is this week in Vancouver, and so a good friend of mine, Mike Seymour, has been doing a lot of testing with around this, and it is a there's a lot of people talking about it. Real-time ray tracing. I mean, ray tracing when we started was hours. Like, oh, you got to ray trace a single image, and it's going to take you, 8 hours.
I remember. Look how good they looked, though, right? Because it's literally trying to trace the path of the light source to the object and what that impact would be for millions of points, right?
Well, there's ray tracing, and then you have global illumination, which is almost the opposite of that. Anyway, the point is that it's now doing ray tracing in real time. So now it's 30 frames a second. It's just an incredible amount of processing power. And it really is going to start becoming a problem, because I don't see AMD, you know, keeping up with this high performance that NVIDIA is doing. I think from an architectural perspective, they're disadvantaged. And so I think that as a result, we as users, I mean, I look at it, I mean, I look at this as, you know, I'm going to use a Mac to manage projects, you know, but when we think about doing the projects, we're not considering, I mean, we don't long term, for real time, for heavy duty lifting, you know, we're not thinking that we're going to do it on a Mac.
10 billion, you know, like that's 10 billion gigarrays, 10 gigarrays per second is how you measure this stuff. That's the fastest Turing parts. It is both rasterization and ray tracing. So it's kind of you get both in one chip. Wow. Yeah.
It's a lot of power, you know, and it's going to make a huge difference when you start talking about, there's a couple things. One is, of course, AR, VR, XR or MR, you know, mixed reality. So having those kinds of things makes a big difference in how things, you know, come. And this is going to get much more complicated and much more realistic. The other piece is really film, actually TV and film production. So there's a friend of mine that I used to work with at Lucasfilm named David Dezoritz, who actually, you know, he has a show, Zafari, which is, it's a kid show, and it is all rendered in real time, you know, and so when you
what?
Think about, you know,
in real time.
And we were close. We worked on this show called Video Mods for VH1 more than a decade ago. And we were rendering some real time stuff that didn't look didn't look amazing, but we were like, hey, this is the future.
Well, I mean, you remember in 1996, I was of 3D character called Dev Null that was rendered in real time, but it took $1 million for the hardware, and it was really crappy looking.
Well, and now we're talking about stuff that looks really realistic that's happening in real time. And this is, that's, you know, amazing. There's a lot of stuff in visualization. There's a lot of pieces when it comes to visualizing cars, visualizing, you know, locations, you know, for industrial reasons. But I think, you know, when I think about some of the shows that, you know, we want to do someday in the future, you know, we're really thinking about how do we do that in real time? How do we render the whole thing? You know, and Saturday morning cartoons, I think we're going to see, they'll all be real time, I think, in the next decade. You know, they'll be rendered in real time because it lowers the cost. It gives you a lot more flexibility.
This begs the question, did Apple bet on the wrong horse by supporting?
It's not a wrong
Radeon,
or right horse.
AMD? I think,
from a pure performance perspective, I would say yes. From a process management, probably not. You know, that they were never going to have the control that Apple wanted over. You know, the problem is that too much of their operating system, too much of the GUI that you're looking at, is driven by the graphics processor. They need to write the drivers. I think that they have to do that. And NVIDIA doesn't want to give that up either. And so the issue is that they just, from a pure process management position, there was no way Apple and NVIDIA could get along. I think the unfortunate part of it is I think that NVIDIA is starting to pull away from AMD from a performance perspective. Maybe AMD can turn it around, but, you know, we don't think about a lot of AMD, you know, processors for what we do.
Renee, is it too late for Apple to change its mind?
I mean, it's not that it's not too late. It's just that nothing has changed. I mean, there was a couple things that were inciting incidents, like NVIDIA had a massive failure that Apple felt they never took responsibility for. There's a bunch of videos you can watch on YouTube. There's one from Adore TV recently that sort of explains why NVIDIA is not the best, not a lot of people are actually fans of NVIDIA. Love the cards, but the company is really bad reputation. And, you know, Apple was one of the companies that took the brunt of that. But also,
Apple could license, I mean, NVIDIA is a fabless foundry, right? They could license the technology just as they license ARM's architecture.
I think NVIDIA is so successful that they just don't care about Apple.
They won't do it, yeah.
Where AMD will do any, like, include Apple. AMD will support Apple's metal at the metal level.
Isn't Apple ultimately going to choose make their own, you think?
Maybe. I mean, AMD also, like, everyone counted them out on CPUs, and now there's Threadripper.
True.
So it's impossible to count them out. But Apple might move. Apple, you know, they sever ties with imagination, and they're making their own GPUs for iOS devices now.
Right.
So who knows what they'll do next generation. They have all the talent in the world, like the legends of AMD and NVIDIA and all those companies are working at Apple. So it's hard to predict what they'll do in the future.
Actually,
go ahead. One handicap towards them trying to do that sort of stuff in-house, that it's not just the hardware, it's the culture of people that learn how to absolutely squeeze that silicon to excruciating levels of pain to get the most performance out of it, which is why you often see the same hardware outperforming it 18 months later, simply because developers who are creating these rendering tools or creating these gaming tools have figured out exactly where the bottlenecks are, or figuring out new methods of exploiting its architecture that hadn't even been considered yet. So it depends on what you think that they're going to be using a GPU for. Everything that you're using your Mac for, and even your iPhone for today, it's essentially a very high performance video game with all of the rendering that has to happen just to make a dialog box, excuse me, just to make an alert for a piece of spam mail appear on the screen. But if you're really trying to create live real time renders of stuff, if you're trying to do a lot of AR stuff, if you're trying to do the sort of really high performance stuff that's not consumer oriented, but is actually industry oriented, where you're charging a god darn fortune in consulting fees to create this bespoke solution for this industry, that's where Apple might be falling down now. But we'll have to find out. GPUs, if you told me 10 years ago how important a GPU is going to be, that's not just going to be about increasing the frame rate in a game, that this is going to be all about artificial intelligence, this is all going to be all about artificial reality and augmented reality, I would not have gotten it, because I am always a lot dumber than I will be in 5 years' time.
Yeah, and some respects, GPUs are more important than the CPU. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, and to their credit, NVIDIA has been talking about this for 10 or 15 years. I mean, they definitely had this focus for a long time. I remember going to SIGGRAPH, and they were showing off, you can do the graphics, and then here's all the other processing you can use GPUs for. So it is definitely there. And I think that there are things that GPUs are really good at and things that they're not good at. They're not good at, a GPU is really good at, obviously, raw performance. It's really good at putting out a lot of pixels at one time. It's really good at doing big processes that are simple. What they're not good at is complex processes, that especially things that are running in parallel. So a lot of parallel processing, I mean, they can do that if they're architected well. But if you look at like the photogrammetry stuff that we do, there's this heavy lifting that the GPU will do if you have a good GPU. But then a lot of the calculations still sit on the CPU. And there's just things that a CPU is better at. CPU, in my opinion, is more stable. You get more of a stable outcome. A lot of the encoders that we use, the elementals that we used, a lot early on, they were, and they still are a pretty heavy GPU. But, sometimes we've had more success on CPU.
And then there's FPGAs, what everybody's talking about, right? That's the...
Well, and then the FPGAs are great because they're low level, they're very inexpensive, and you can reprogram them. The challenge is they're all based in China, and if you talk to the right people, they talk about the fact that if you let an FPGA touch the internet, it calls home, period.
Really?
Yeah, it is not. Yeah, ooh. They are not. There's a lot of folks that I've talked to that have concerns.
That's interesting. There's a defense appropriation bill just passed, and it includes... rules against using ZTE and Huawei parts in anything that the Defense Department does. Now maybe they'll have to extend that. This is a eGPU from Razer that can handle, right now there's an AMD card in it, but I could put and might even try an NVIDIA card in here. But Renee, I'd have to use flaky drivers,
I think they're beta. I mean, some people have done it. It's just they're not going to be as good as cleanly supported solutions from both parties.
We'll try it. I mean, I'm going to try. We're going to benchmark this, compare this to the Apple, kind of exclusive Blackmagic eGPU, and then maybe I'll get. I have a 1080 Ti.
How many slots is that?
I don't know.
If I could open it, I would, but I don't. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe if I do that and that. Oh, there you go.
There's a handle on the back for easy access. It's got a sapphire in here right now, but it looks like just one fat slot for any GPU. And a rather large amount of cooling, at least two-thirds of the case is cooling.
Right.
Yeah. So this is kind of interesting, though. We'll do a benchmark. I think this Saturday on the new Screensavers, I'm going to show benchmarks on the MacBook, that i9 MacBook Pro. I'm trying to get my money's worth.
This is really something that it's amazing that we've gotten to the point where you can, with USB-C specifically, that you got to a point where you could just externalize
Not USB-C, Thunderbolt 3. I mean, you, well, you need the 40 gigabit throughput of Thunderbolt 3 to really make this
make
sense.
I just meant the connector, but it's amazing that we've gotten to a point where we can just externalize the motherboard. Yeah,
it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling. That's I think it's only $300 for the case, but then, you know, as much as you want for the card. It doesn't come with card not included. Speaking of returning superstars, Doug Field is coming back to Apple. He left to go to Tesla in 2013, 5 years ago. He is now coming back to work with Bob Mansfield. This is a rumor that John Gruber's reporting at Daring Fireball. And Mansfield, of course, is in charge of the Project Titan, the Apple self-driving car. So Doug Field leaving autopilot from Tesla and going, he oversees Model 3 production. And going back
this,
to
this Apple. all looks fairly straightforward, that he lost his position at Tesla, you know, when Elon Musk stepped in to push things forward. And of course, he puts him in a position where he's going to want to leave. I will say that, the conspiracy theorist in me does say that if I wanted to figure out everything I needed to know about doing a car, I would let one of my engineers go to Tesla and have them then come back.
Ooh, that's asking for a lawsuit. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's kind of that's the Red Sparrow convenient model of car autonomous car development.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm guessing that there was a prenup involved.
I'm sure there's a little contractual stuff going back and forth there. But Apple and Tesla, there's kind of a revolving door, really. Between Apple and Tesla, and I imagine, and Google and Tesla, and all these guys, Waymo.
They keep the problem with all these projects is that they keep changing directions. Like the flow. So, a senior executive at an automaker will have been talked into, seduced into joining Apple because they thought they were building a car, and then a year and a half later, they're not building a car; they're building a platform, and now this is not as interesting to that person as before. And sometimes it goes the other way around. So this is it is so completely in flux right now that this is why you're playing musical chairs with engineers and project managers.
Well, and I think it's also so complicated because, you know, what is the future of a car? I mean, I think we're in this position where we don't even know. I mean, when Google came out with the there's no steering wheel and you're just going to get in and it's going to take you, I was like, that is crazy. I am never giving up my steering wheel. And now I've gotten to a point where I'm like, I really don't want a steering wheel. Like, I just want a monitor up there and I just sit back and watch something. And I the more I've thought through it and the more I've sat in back of Ubers and stuff like that, I'm just like, I don't need to be able to grab onto that. I just stop and pull over on the road if you're broken. I think that a lot of folks have had to, do we really spend billions on building a new shiny, heads-up display across our windshield, or do we just get rid of the windshield? You know, and I think that that's the, you know, I think we're in that point where we don't know which way it's going to go.
Brene can explain this to us. Apple pulls iOS 12 beta 7 after less than 24 hours. The rumor is there were performance issues, and then the group FaceTime, the 32 concurrent user FaceTime, was also removed from beta 7. The release notes say it will ship in a future software update this fall. In other words, and some made this conclusion, maybe it's the FaceTime group chat that's leading to a problem in iOS 12.
No, I mean, I think those are separate, very separate decisions. One is because there was a bug in this beta that trashed performance on some versions of iPhone. So you pull the beta, you fix it, and you re-release it as soon as possible.
Right.
The other one is that similar to the iMessage sync last year. You know, Apple tries to project forward what are the features that we could finish. And famously this year, they dropped a few features because they wanted to take some of the key engineers and have them spend their time on performance optimization. Like, for example, the guy who invented auto layout stopped what he was doing for this release and went back and made auto layout as performant as possible on iOS 12. But still, not all you can't always guess exactly how long a project will take, especially when it's something at the architectural level of FaceTime, which, because of a variety of different circumstances over the years, has been a massive architectural overhaul for Apple. And now you're throwing 32 concurrent connections that we maintained at the same time, and they're just not going to make the deadline. So instead of releasing a version of FaceTime group calls that's not great, that's going to get them more, Apple can't, Apple's buggy or Apple's doing this or that wrong, they're just going to wait like they did with iMessage sync last year and like they did with AirPlay 2. And if you notice, there's similarity between all of these features, and just wait until they've absolutely nailed it. And then it will come out either, you know, in iOS 12.1 or 0.2 or, you know, maybe 0.3 if things really slip.
Should someone who got Beta 7 before they pulled it worry about it? Somebody in the chat room is saying it's running fine on my iPad Air 2.
Yeah, if it's running fine, there'll be a new one right away. But if it's not running fine, just roll yourself back and
Folks on the public beta, we're at 6 now.
It is this version, but it usually comes a couple days late, so they didn't ship the version for public yet. So they'll fix that before they ship.
Yeah, we're like weekly now on those betas, right?
Yeah, but the difference is, like, the public beta, they know that. I mean, they warn people, but they know that most likely people don't have multiple devices, so they're going to put it on their carry device. Right. Developers are expressly told not to put it on a carry device. Yeah. It is not an early access program. And some people still do, and then you get bit by stuff like this, but that's sort of caveat emptor at that point.
You know, it's been a while since I have brushed my teeth manually. I am now, like, all into the automatic toothbrush, so much so that when I picked up a old-fashioned toothbrush the other day, I didn't really know what to do with it. I was like, how do you brush your teeth? My wrist didn't have the muscles to do it. Right now, I am using a Quip. This is the best toothbrush. What do I call it? I just call it a toothbrush. It's an automatic, an electric toothbrush. It's not really electric anymore. I guess you call it an electric toothbrush. It's a fraction of the cost of those high-end, and it does just as well. We're starting $25. We're starting for this Quip toothbrush. It's the first subscription electric toothbrush approved by the American Dental Association. See, it turns out, a lot of us brush our teeth wrong. Either we don't do it long enough or we forget to change our brushes. Quip solves that. It's, of course, got the automatic. Every 30 seconds, do another quadrant of your mouth. You get 2 minutes of guided pulses that tell you when to switch sides so you know how to brush. And you automatically get new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, and that includes free shipping worldwide. Quip is really sweet. There's no charger. So it can come with a mount like that you put right on your mirror so you'll never forget to brush. This is what we're taking to Barcelona because it's the best travel brush ever. Instead of a charger, it uses a AAA battery. So when it's time to, after a few months, when it's time to charge it, instead of charging, you put another battery in. Perfect for travel. You never have to worry. Everyone loves Quip. Oprah put them on the O-list. Time Magazine's Best Inventions. First subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the ADA. And backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and of course, hundreds of thousands of happy brushers like me. It's so affordable. We got an extra one and a few extra heads, and because kids, when they come for the sleepover, with Michael, we do a sleepover every Friday night. They never bring their toothbrush. That's probably pretty typical for teenagers, right? Toothbrush? What are you talking about? So we have, and we label their names. We say, "Yes, now go brush your teeth."
I love a Quip. Great toothpaste, too. It gives you that nice, minty, fresh flavor.
Quip was founded to prove that good design would have a bigger impact on oral health than quick-fix gimmicks, and it's working. $25. Go to getquip, getquip.com/twit right now. Your first refill pack is free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. And if you're one of those fancy Apple owners, you want a fancier brush, you can spend more on the copper handle and all that stuff. But I just like the basic $25 model. It's great. Gets the job done. Get your first refill pack free. Getquip.com/twit. We thank Quip for their support and doing what they do to support dental health all around the world. Look, see, it goes, this is how we travel with it. Comes with a nice little test tube. Put that right in your suitcase. You get the little suitable for TSA screening 2 weeks worth of Quip toothpaste right there. Getquip.com/twit. All right. Now that I'm minty fresh, let's get a pick of the week from Andy and Otko.
I got it too. One was a sort of a last minute ad. We were talking earlier. These are the Butler soy curls.
Oh, you weren't joking.
I was not joking. These are really real. A friend of mine introduced me to these like a few years ago, and they've always been in my kitchen ever since. What these are is that they're like, this is proof positive. I keep like in my pantry like a, some Lucy's over there. There are, through some sort of a patented process that they explain, they take soy and they turn it into these like little, like completely dried little chunks and strips. And all you got to do to reactivate them is you just get some really, really hot water. Doesn't even have to be boiling. You just put them in a cup with whatever flavoring you like. I usually drop some chicken stock or whatever, chicken bouillon or whatever in there. Wait for 10 minutes. There, now they will absorb all the flavor of whatever you put in there. And then you have this really tasty, meaty, a chewy sort of meat sort of thing, only it's not meat, it's soy. And I'm not a vegetarian. I've been thinking about doing a vegetarian day of the week just to get my cooking back into strap. But it's such a basic staple for like when I really don't want to cook, but I don't want to like eat junk and go out for dinner. I will just heat up some black beans. I will reconstitute some soy curls with some chicken stock. And then it will just be a really, really tasty meal. There, you can put them in an instant pot with barbecue sauce, and it becomes a lot like barbecue chicken. It doesn't try to be something that it's not. I always describe these as I'm eating soy curls. I'm not eating like some sort of substitute turkey or substitute chicken, but it gives you that sort of meat experience that you really, really like. It tastes like whatever you want it to taste like. And I will also say that I love the fact that a bag of these, it costs about $3 for an 8-ounce bag, and it's almost completely, as you can expect, shelf stable. So it's not as
I mean, for foods that will survive the nuclear apocalypse.
Well, not just that. It's like there are times when like I've either. There are times when like I'll buy my usual pork cutlets and chicken breasts, but like maybe I've already gone through what I bought and the fridge is empty and I still want to have something that's actually like sort of sustenance.
Andy,
and I will always have a supply of these
in a 12-pound bulk bag for only $191. You'd never run out.
There are people who do that. They do like real barbecue about it. They can buy them in like little chunks. You can buy them in big strips.
All right, I buy
a box of these like every 2 or 3 months, which means that even when like I've been traveling, like last week I was out of the house and traveling every day for last week, and there's nothing in the fridge. When I come home after a week, I can quickly throw together like an actual meal because there's always going to be something like there's always going to be like this jar or another bag.
Next week around on the show, we're going to have a taste off between Butler's soy curls and the Bull and Cleaver traditional biltong that I also purchased thanks to Apple Pay, and we can see which is better. Well, we know what we should do. We should get some blindfold people in here. Maybe the studio audience will subject you. All right, what's your other pick, Andy?
Oh, man. The pick they already had is a Spyglass GPS, which I, as an app that I didn't realize I needed until I needed it and didn't have it. We are so reliant on Apple Maps and Google Maps that we don't even think about having like a navigation app that doesn't require like a big, big server to connect to. Spyglass GPS is sort of like a on-device navigation orienteering app. It is a much better compass than whatever you're going to get in that app. You can. It's very good for when you're basically taking a walk and you need to like land a place mark or keep a trail of where you've been going. There are times where you do find if you're lucky enough to live near a park or conservation land, you find that Google Maps and Apple Maps is not going to help you get out of that park. It's also not going to help you remember where the exit is. And you'll be able to do that if you have this app on you because it kept a trail of where your car is parked and how to get back there, and or just simply where the hell is north. How do I get without any landmarks, without any sunlight? Here's how I get in and out of places. The basic app gives you a very, very good compass for $6. It gives you all the stuff like being able to download maps and keep them offline, HUD features, augmented reality features. Like I said, it's a great app to simply download today, have it on the phone, and then sometime in the next 20 hours to 3 years, when you're like, oh my God, I'd be, if only I had a real like compass app that doesn't rely on a connection to Google Maps or Apple Maps. Oh, wait a minute. I actually do. I forgot that before I started on this long, long drive to this park, and before I ran out of a radio signal here, I actually do have something that will help me get out of here today, as opposed today on foot and by car, as opposed to 2 days from now dehydrated and via an emergency helicopter. So, and it really is just such a cool app. Besides, it's like really a beautiful piece of craftsmanship. So I'm very, very pleased to have it on my phone now.
Mr. Rene Ritchie, your pick of the week.
I have two quick picks. One is Fantastical has been updated yet again. Fantastical for Mac. It's just got a lot of quality of life features. I guess the big new feature is this integrates with Meetup now. So if you use Meetup, you can have that right in your calendar app. But there's just a lot of little things that have been polished. And if like me, you're not a huge fan of Apple's built-in calendar app, then Fantastical absolutely has you covered.
Works so well with Drafts too. I always, you know,
totally
try to remember something. I press the button, record the, you know, haircut at 3 p.m. on Friday, and then when I get back home, I open my iPad and I just Fantastical because it understands natural language. I use the drop down menu on my Mac too. You just type in lunch with Lisa, and it does the right thing. I really love that. Right,
it's the fastest way to get stuff into your calendar and then find it again afterwards. Yeah. And I hate Michael Simmons for that because I really don't want to be using a calendar, but he makes it so easy that I have no excuses not to use it. So
I also use CardHop, which I highly recommend.
He fixes so many apps, one app at a time. Him and Ken Sutherland, a really good team.
If you have CardHop and Fantastical in your menu on your Mac, you're set. You're done.
Yep.
Everything, it's all there.
He even fixed iMessage with Chatology, but I don't know if he's still doing that. But stuff he does is great. It's all fantastic. My second pick is blatantly self-serving, but we have vector pins and T-shirts in. And it was a surprise to me because I forgot they were making them, but they are just really awesome looking. So, and pins. After Apple announced pins at WWDC, I immediately wanted all the pins. So I've got like my peacock pin and a bunch of other pins, and now I just ordered some vector pins.
That's, you know, maybe we should do pins too. You're right. I never thought of pins. Yeah. Yeah, maybe we should.
I would take a bandolier of Twit pins.
All right. Where do we find that? imore.com/vector?
That's standard.tv/vector.
Okay.
It's the standard store.
standard.tv/vector.
Yeah.
Alex Lindsay, pick of the week, my friend.
So, a long time ago, we were trying to do compositing. Compositing is combining, you know, green screen and people and putting things together. And we got to work with some developers, and we put together this little app that we used to sell. It was one of my favorite apps ever.
I remember you talking about this on Call for Help, I think.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah. And so we put it together. We sold it for a while. It just didn't find the right niche. I think we weren't charging enough, to be honest with you. It was so powerful that we just didn't, you know, and complicated, that we needed to charge a lot more for it. It's been used on a lot of effects, for live on set visualization. But the reality is it's this Swiss Army knife that you can do almost anything in real time when it comes to compositing and a lot of screen effects. So it's free now, and it's been free, and we've used it, and it just got updated. So Poly just updated this to 64-bit, so it's brand new and shiny. There might be a couple rough edges as he goes out. I've just got it, and so far it's been working great. So it's fast. You can throw it on your latest Mac, and it's Mac only, so it's not being, you know, the code is really just for the Mac. It's free, and it's basically, if you think about Nuke or Shake, what I wanted when we started having this conversation was I wanted Shake, but I wanted it to be real time. And so, anyway, it is, it's not a replacement for Nuke or Shake, but what it's great for is just, there is an enormous number of effects. And Polly, who writes it, he uses it for all kinds of crazy stage, stage events and so on and so forth to do things on the screen. So there's plugins in there that I have no idea what they even do. I look at them, I'm like, this looks cool, but there's a lot of great stuff you can do. back then we built literally 3D compositing. So you can do a green screen composite in real time in 3D and play around with the interocular or interaxial. Anyway, so there's an incredible number of pieces in the near future. Now that the 64-bit one is out, I'm probably going to do some training that is, you know, for it's great to talk about using classes because you get instant feedback. I can show you a green screen and I can be, it's actually live and I can change things and you can watch all the things change as I do it. And so, so I'll be using it, in the near future. So my recommendation, if you're at all interested, is to, and really my recommendation is just to download it and play with it. It's that you can, it'll turn onto your webcam. You can start playing with it almost instantly and you get to kind of see what a nodal compositor, you know, looks like, and it's free and easy. Not, I wouldn't say it's easy to use like an iPhone app. It's a little heavy, but it is, but it really gives you a lot of really cool high-end tools. And because of the real-time feedback, you can learn faster because, you know, you get to really see it happening. You can even, you know, push in live video, put in multiple streams of live video, output live video. So there's just a lot of great, great little bits. And it's free. It's free, which is absolutely insane. And I was really excited. I just got surprised, actually, that Pauly had gone ahead and updated it to 64-bit. And so I'm really excited that it's out. I'm going to use it in the near future. And if you have a Mac, you should download it and play with it.
I have no idea what you would use this for. I wish you would come in sometime and sit down with us for a while and show us some stuff.
How about, you know, I could come in on Saturday. You know, there's the show.
Okay. Come on the new Screensavers. Come on the new Screensavers.
I'm actually on the new Screensavers this Saturday.
Oh, to show this?
No, but we could talk to Anthony about it if you want.
Yeah, let's add this to the mix. Oh, good. Yeah, I'm glad you're going to be on because that's what I'm going to do, the eGPU comparison. I'll need your help for that as well. Could I? Perfect. Okay, so let's say I shot S-Log video. Could I use this?
You should be able to convert it. I haven't tried to convert.
So I have S-Log to create a LUT for it, right?
Yeah, I think that there's LUTs in there.
Is it that kind of thing where you have a signal that's coming in and you do stuff to it and something comes out the other end?
Yeah, but it happens in real time. So really it's not so much taking, you can take files and do it in real time.
That's a very simplified description, kids.
But what I used it for, we had to do about 110 visual effects shots for a movie about 10 years ago. And what we used it for is we're on set, we've already shot the background plate, and we have a couple foreground pieces. And what we had to do, the actors were so busy, we couldn't shoot them at the same time. So the problem that we had is that we had to shoot one. They were literally sitting next to each other, talking to each other. Now we had their actual doubles sitting next to each other doing the actual. So there'd be the girl was on one side and the double was on the other. And then the guy was on the other side. And then the girl's double was on, you know, we shot them weeks apart. And so we had to make sure that everything lined up, eyes and the background, because they were in Santa Monica, but we were shooting them in Japan. And so there was all this bits and pieces. I got to bring in foregrounds and elements and background elements and make sure that they all line up. Now, if you shoot that without being able to see what's actually happening, that's why how effects have little problems. I'm not in big visual effects, but in little movies, you end up with little problems or big problems. And so what we did is on set on a 17-inch laptop, you know, whatever was the fastest thing 10 years ago, we were able to do all of that in real time, you know. And so it basically do the composite, pull the green screens, put the background in, do all the little bits and pieces, do color correction, everything. So while we were there on set, we could know that it was going to work. And we literally had the director come up and look at it. And it's a real-time feed showing the foreground and the background. And he's like, so is it going to look this good in the film? And I was like, yeah, it's going to look at least as good. This is in the film,
so,
you know, and so
again, I have no idea what you do this, but it is free.
We'll come in. Free. We will.
How much did you charge for Conduit when it first came out?
We used to charge, I think it was 100, 150 or 200 bucks.
And then you'd buy the special of the additional kit, capture tools, right? Stage tools.
Yeah, you'd buy some of those extra. And so
this is hundreds of dollars worth of software. You're just giving it away.
Oh yeah. And it's not me giving it away. It's Pauly giving it away. You know, we were licensing it and selling it.
Okay. Thank you, Pauly. That's awesome.
Yeah. It should have been thousands of dollars worth of hardware. That was the problem with the business model is that
you didn't charge
the number
enough
of people using it. We didn't charge enough that we had made enough money for the, you know, it was a specialized crew. Now what we're hoping to do is expand that a little bit what I think, I mean, Polly's just put it out there, I think, because he's using it. I think he updated it for himself and figured, well, I might as well give it to everybody. Wow. And so so I'm super excited about it. And I'm again, planning to do some training this fall with it. And so you should download it. You should play with it. We'll probably do stuff within our Patreon thing about it at first and then make it more public later.
PixelConduit.com. PixelConduit.com. Download it free right now. So Alex started MacBreak many moons ago. It was it was a video production, a crazy 1080p video production that he could barely edit, and, well, and pretty much no one could watch. But it was awesome, and most of the early episodes were about how the hell you make this thing, and they featured Sal Segoyan, one of the great legendary people of Apple. Sal came in on Friday for the first of two triangulations. Awesome. He went on and on, so we made it into two shows. It is awesome. The stories he tells about Steve Jobs. He says, I don't want to be the guy who's telling stories about Steve Jobs, but he worked with him for a decade, and he has some stories. He also talked a lot about automation, which he is keeping alive. He left Apple a few years ago. But he's keeping it alive with his Command D conference, his work for the Omni Group, and more. And he gave us a demo of something that's been built into Mac OS for more than a decade, 13 years, that Apple has never demoed on stage. If they did, it would be like Minority Report. People would go, you can do that? Voice commands, automating things like Keynote. You've got to watch the triangulation from Friday, and then he does the full demo of the dictation commands next Friday's triangulation, or you can go to dictationcommands.com. But it's kind of complicated, and I think, but when, if you see, there's something wrong with his, I can't get his video to play, but he plays it for us on the show and you can watch it. But if you watch Sal working with a Keynote presentation and his voice in combination doing things like that, that would like make a panorama that would take forever, it will blow your mind. And Sal is so great. So
absolutely,
it's a person, it's a little bit of a plug for my stuff, but I have to say it's really not. It's a plug for Sal Segoyan. twit.tv/TRI. Watch the current episode and then make sure you watch next week's for the dictation commands. That's amazing. Yeah, you know, everybody knows Sal. We
love Sal. I also want to thank you for getting so many Apple legends to basically create oral histories that are going to be preserved, because there's so much of this story that's going to inform and inspire people, no matter what sort of job they take in tech or elsewhere, to learn what it's like to be in a position to do really, really great things in a very, very competitive and high-pressure situation. And the more of these people that you can get to sit down for 1 hour, 2 hour, 8 days and tell every story that they have and make sure that's there, that's such a great thing for history.
Well, we'll probably get Sal back. I want to do more of this. In fact, I really want him to do some tips for us. So we're going to figure out some way to get Sal to do kind of what he already did in the earliest days of MacBreak, some more for us on that. And to that note, so next week on Triangulation is Sal on the 24th, and you'll want to watch this. We're going to do it at 3 p.m.?
Correct.
On the 24th, which is a week from Friday, Bill Atkinson returns, who is, of course, the legendary guy who created QuickDraw, wrote much of the early Lisa code, wrote Mac Paint, was the heart and soul of the Macintosh. Bill is a legend. He's a wonderful guy. He's come on many times now. And have we told Bill what we're going to do?
We have not, but we will.
I have some ideas. One of the things I'd like to do, the Mac Paint source code is out. Lalisa source code is out. I wouldn't mind having Bill run through a little source code. I don't know if he wants to do this, but I would like the one of the greatest programmers of all time and a true genius to just talk a little bit about coding. But we'll see. Bill will also want to talk about Photocard, which is his current project, which is the must-have iOS app that lets you mail postcards, and we do it every year for our Christmas card. I do it as every time I travel, and I love it. You must check out PhotoCard. Bill Atkinson is August 24th, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That'll be another Karsten 3 or 4 hour show, I'm thinking. We might
yes,
have,
yes, it will.
We might have episodes all September
we'll have
long.
Several episodes coming out of that.
And Andy, to your point, when I can get together with these guys, it just fills my soul. This is my favorite stuff to talk about in all the world. So thank you to the great folks who are willing to come in and chat. It's really fun. And Bill, you know, we talked a lot about Bill a couple of weeks ago because we were talking about General Magic and Magic Link and that and that wonderful new documentary. And Atkinson was very much, you know, the one of the leaders of General Magic, which invented the iPhone 10 years before the iPhone became a reality. So that'll be fun, too. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We appreciate it. We like to talk to the legends of the Apple world right here on our stage. People like Rene Ritchie of iMore.com watch his Vector podcast. He gets all the big names. iMore.com/Vector. Always a great read, great listen. Mr. Andy Inatko, INATKO at Inatko.com or at Inatko on Twitter or on WGBH's Andy Inatko. That's what I want to say. WGBH's Andy Inatko.
I'm going to be on again on Thursday. Check my Twitter for the actual time. I think it's 12:30 as usual on WGBH. And if you're going to be in Boston, we are going to be recording at the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. So you can actually see everything happen live and have a cup of coffee, a scone, and perhaps a sandwich while
you're there. Very nice. Alex Lindsay, a thrill to have you on as always from your Washington, D.C. headquarters, world headquarters. Pixelcore.com at Alex Lindsay on the Twitter. Yeah, we do Mac Break Weekly each and every Tuesday around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time, 1800 UTC. You are more than welcome to stop by. We actually had a very nice studio audience came in today. If you want to be in the studio audience, just email tickets at twit.tv. If your vacation plans or your business plans bring you to the Northern California area, we're in Petaluma, about an hour north of San Francisco. We'd love to have you come by. If you can't make it in person, you can always watch the live stream at twit.tv/live. We have live audio and video you get to pick. And if you're doing that, you absolutely ought to be in our chat room with all the other people watching live at irc.twit.tv. After the show, we edit it down. We put a beginning, a middle, and an end on. We make some sense out of it. We bleep out all the swear words like and I guess you had to bleep those, right? And then make it available for download at twit.tv/MBW for Mac Break Weekly or wherever you get your podcasts. In fact, if you subscribe, you won't have to do anything. It'll just appear in your Pocket Casts or your Overcast or your iTunes automatically each and every Tuesday afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Mac Break Weekly. Now, back to work because break time's over.